welcome to episode 207 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Jesse Alva
and Lydia Creech.
In today's Girls Only episode, we're going to be talking about movies we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with 1983's Risky Business. But first, girls, before we get into the topics, let's talk about what's on the site real quick, because we have some Gucci.
Oh. Gucci.
We're also going to be eighth graders. Gucci picks.
Yeah.
We have The Mamma Mia Maniac. Paige Taylor, full of GIFs, whatever you want to call
GIFs.
Them.
She made talking them about, herself.
People who call it GIFs talking can about go Mamma home. Mia. It's GIFs. Right. It's GIFs forever.
There's all of our GIF listeners. Thank you.
Sorry, guys.
We also have a review of Hillbilly, the documentary that was played at the Scruffy City Film Festival, and the movie we're about to talk about, Eighth Grade. Andrew Swafford wrote a review of that. It's on the site now. We also got his wonderful video essay on Guns Don't Kill People, Knives Kill People, which if you have not checked out, it's still there. So do that. All right, let's dish.
Cool.
So the first movie we're going to be talking about is Eighth Grade. It is the first film by writer-director Bo Burnham. It stars Elsie Fisher as Kayla, who is in her last week of being in eighth grade and is about to go on to high school and is trying to use that as a kind of catalyst to improve herself and finds more about her personality and find more friends and just kind of feel better overall, because she feels that she's too quiet and too awkward and struggles to interact with other people. And it covers this week where various events include: she goes to a pool party, she meets a high school girl who she shadows for the day and then lets her hang out with her friends afterwards. There's just a lot of stuff. We just kind of go through her day. Lydia talked about it a little bit last week. So Jesse, how about you and I start with our thoughts? What did you make of Eighth Grade?
I really liked it. I really liked it. I should also add the context that I work in a middle school. I mostly work in special education, but I also monitor a bus. So I spend a lot of time with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And so I know them. I know that they're awful, and I also know that they're wonderful. I love middle school. It's fun. And so, like, everybody came out of there thinking, like, wow, middle school's not really that bad. Or it is, but they're really going through a lot. And I was kind of like, yeah, I already knew that because I work in a middle school. Like, this is not novel information. You just meet a middle school and spend time with... Anyway, so I liked it. But I feel like everybody else liked it more because they're like, wow, insight into a middle schooler's life. And I was like, yeah, that's how it is. I know. It's great. I think it's a great movie. And I think that it really does a good job capturing kind of the cognitive growth that she's going through as a person. Kind of doing a lot of, starting to breach into some like metacognition of thinking about her own thinking, like thinking about, I don't know, just kind of becoming more self-aware of her experiences and the things that she's saying on her online platform, and how she can use that as advice for herself. She's kind of therapizing herself, and that's sort of what, and that's completely what Andrew talks about in his review. You should check it out. And that's cool. I mean, I'm studying to be a school counselor, so I'm learning about developmental stages, and that's pretty consistent. And so I think that's a good reflection of that kind of cognitive growth that happens. Yeah.
I feel like there is that kind of universality that people have been latching onto, because everybody remembers how awkward or whatever it is to be in middle school, and especially being eighth grade transitioning into high school. But I feel like what's so well done in this movie is really it doesn't seem to, and Bo Burnham has talked about this, it doesn't seem to care about being this whole universal this is how everybody felt in eighth grade. It's more, this is how what it feels like to be in middle school in 2018. There's this really kind of striking somewhat sad sequence that opens the movie where Kayla is doing one of her YouTube videos, and we watch the whole thing just in one single shot as it slowly pans closer to her, and she's talking, and I don't know. I really appreciated the fumbles that she had, the but and the you know and the like she had that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. It was less that she. You know. It was less that she wasn't intelligent. She's clearly very curious and very intelligent, but it was more that she hadn't reached that vocabulary level, even though she wanted to express more of her ideas that were clearly rolling around in her brain over the course of the movie.
You gotta practice,
exactly.
Right?
And so I kind of, on a level, I appreciated that. I thought it was so sweet that she is attempting to express herself in a really true and genuine way. But also you have this element of technology and social media. And I think that that's going to be a major turnoff for a lot of viewers, just because they're going to be like, oh, they're going to get in that a complete immediate negative field of, oh, technology is dumb. These kids are dumber because all they do is sit on their phones all day, blah, blah, blah. I mean, just go and find any baby boomer sitting in a doctor's office.
Sure.
You can hear that whole thing.
Yeah, but also I don't think that's exclusive to middle schoolers. Like, people my age are the same way, where you can't have much of a conversation with them without them being on their phones. And it's like, I don't know, it's not a sensation that's exclusive to the younger generation, so to speak. It's just... it's a grind. Even my own mom, like, she's a little better at it now, but there were times, especially when I was in college, where I would visit with her and she'd just be on her phone playing like Candy Crush or something, you know. Anyway, that's a side, this is a whole side thing.
No, there's a whole thing about how actually the parents of these eighth graders are more addicted to their phones than the eighth graders, just because, and it shows this in eighth grade, that there is this deep understanding on how this technology works, because the kids this age don't know of a world where these things didn't exist. I think that we have a little bit of a window where we didn't have too much technology, and then it's, you know, all the other stuff started happening, so we just had this small window of a non-technological world, really. But they have been inundated with this since day one, and it's just kind of a third arm to them. Like, they're just so used to using this platform. And something I was thinking throughout the movie was how really a lot of people would describe it as depressing, and I think it of course is a little bit depressing, but the just immediately raw and vulnerable position you have when you are expressing yourself through this platform. You know, if you were this age in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s or the 80s or even the 90s, you were able to keep some, you know, clone or some cloak around yourself, so that it wasn't like you were constantly putting yourself out there on so many different platforms, and you could kind of keep to yourself in a sense. But as you see in this movie, Elsie Fisher is the actor. Kayla, you know, she feels like the only way that she can connect with people is through these mediums of specifically Instagram and Snapchat and YouTube. And personally, I felt empathy for her. Like, I was just like, this has to be so difficult that this is the way people are communicating, and there is this kind of disconnection from humanity whenever they're doing it. And I also think that that she's someone who is, you know, incredibly intelligent, and you see that once she's given the opportunity kind of to speak, she has clear thoughts, just kind of when she has a heart to heart with her dad later, when she's talking to her friend Gabe, who hashtag is my all-time fave. I think that's where the movie excels, and that's what made it so affecting for me. Not because I was like, oh, it was so awkward to be in eighth grade, but I think that the technological anxiety that it examines and how people are forced to interact in today's society is one of the most poignant and empathetic versions that I've seen in movies and possibly forever. Lydia, did you have any additional thoughts after talking about it last week?
I just did want to add that you were talking about baby boomers kind of missing the whole point of this movie. That's how you can tell this movie wasn't made by a baby boomer. Like, the Bo Burnham's our age, and I think just the amount of empathy and kindness that he has towards kids who grew up with technology so thoroughly integrated in their lives. It's non-judgmental, I guess, which is what feels so refreshing.
No, exactly. I think that Yeah, that was one of my immediate thoughts, was this is a movie that isn't made by someone in their 30s or 40s, you know, late 30s, early 40s, or even later 40s, trying to recapture their youth and nostalgia. This is a movie that works as a time capsule for youth in 2018. And I think that that's important to have. We'll probably talk a little bit more about capturing a specific moment in youth when we talk about Risky Business. But the last thing I want to talk about before we move on is, what did you all make, really the scene that stressed me out the most, rather than the awkward scenes, I mean, it was more stressful than watching a horror movie, was when Kayla is in the back seat of this guy's car who's driving her home, and she's driving her and the high school friend that she makes home. The high school friend gets out of the car and he says, yeah, I'll drive her to her house. And instead, you know, I guess spoiler warning if you don't want to know, but he gets out of the car and sits next to her and, you know, starts making a pass at her, and she goes no. And then the thing that's just so crushing that really just sunk my heart was when they're driving back and she's apologizing, and he frames it as, no, you know, I was trying to help you here, and you rejected it, it's your fault. What was processing through your mind when you were watching that scene?
I'm glad that Bo actually included it, because I think that's an experience that a lot of young girls have, regardless of like 2018 technology, whatever, but like young teenage girls, you know, trying to navigate meeting new men for the first time, or like creepy dudes. And to be very clear, the movie makes it very clear that he's being fucking creepy. Like, I think he's a senior in high school, and like seniors in high school, something like that, like, should not be fucking with eighth graders, all the ways that means. And I think it's, I don't know, good of Bo Burnham to include that. Like, not gloss over that that's a real experience that girls have. And teenage boys that are actually creepy and inappropriate like that. And I think her friend knew. The friend that she made, she's like, oh, maybe you should drop her off first.
And I think that this is one of the better portrayals of an incident, you know, something like this in this era of Me Too that we kind of live in, where I think that the really effective part was that Kayla reacted in the way that you should. She just immediately was like, no. But then she went through that cycle of him degrading her and making her feel bad for rejecting him, which is something that a lot of these stories that come up about sexual harassment, sexual misconduct, usually take place, you know, usually contain also. And I think that this kind of works as a lesson for both teenage girls, but also teenage boys, to kind of recognize that even you in this era where everybody's constantly questioning, well, how am I supposed to act? Well, this is how you're not supposed to act, and this should be clear to you.
I think it's also like really clear, like that shit starts early.
Because yeah, I loved your comment, Lydia, that you texted me. It was like that all high school boys are rapists waiting to happen.
They are, though. They are.
Oh, God.
I'm not sorry.
Jesse, did you have any thoughts on that scene? That it kind of provoke you in the same way as it did for us?
I feel like I remember feeling a little worried that she would go along with it, like in an effort to, I don't know, kind of fit in with the high school crowd. And I'm really proud of her character for, you know, having, like, not wanting that, not, I don't know. And she kind of I feel like she realizes earlier in the film, when she's doing some research on YouTube, what she is and isn't willing to do at this stage of herself. And so I'm glad that she doesn't go there. And I also felt a little bad that I had the thought, I'm really glad like nothing bad did happen to her, because something bad could have happened to her. And I wish I didn't have to have that thought of like, well, thank goodness nothing else happened. But like, I feel like it's such an expectation now of like, well, that, you know, that's crummy. I wish that it couldn't be like, well, thank goodness he didn't do anything. Like, I wish, like, well, yeah, of course he didn't, because she said no, and they should respect that. But Yeah. And that, I mean, that moment in the movie really shifts her whole, the tone and kind of her outlook moving forward.
Because this is after she burnt, this is right before she burns her box, right?
Yeah, yeah. She kind of, yeah.
We talked last week also, the last point that I want to make about, you know, whether this is something appropriate for people actually in eighth grade to watch, or and I think that after watching this especially, I affirm that yes, this is something definitely that eighth graders should watch. They may not derive the full effect out of it, but I think that, you know, there's concerns. I was talking with my mom and she was asking if this would be fine for her teacher friends, because her teacher friends are a little bit more conservative when it comes to, you know, language and all of that kind of stuff in movies. And I was like, yeah, there's a couple bits of language. It's more the eighth graders saying it, and they're already saying it in reality also. So it's like, that shouldn't be a shock to you. And then you have a scene where she's, you know, on YouTube searching how to give a blowjob. You have another scene where she's, you know, talking with a boy about exchanging nudes on Snapchat. And then you have the one that we've been talking about. And the thing I told her, though, was that what's great about all of these scenes is she reacts in the best way possible. She, whenever she's, you know, searching up the oral sex on YouTube, she just kind of shuts the computer and it's just like, no.
Yeah, she's like, yikes. Yeah,
she always reacts in the best way. So even though those scenes may yeah. make you uncomfortable initially, I think that the way that she goes about it following that scene is what you would want to strive for, or at least see yeah. in your eighth grade.
And I think that, like, we, you know, the grown-ups tend to think like, oh, we would not want these little eighth graders, these little, you know, below 18 year olds to be exposed to stuff like this. But like, that's the reality. like I said, I work in a middle school. I hear their language. I know what they talk about. Like, this is the reality. And so it's not like they would watch this movie and be like, oh, gad, this yeah. is too much. Like
they're already watching worse movies on yeah, Netflix sure. and stuff.
And I was just thinking, too, of like the It movie that came out last year, the year before. And I'm sure that plenty of young people saw that It movie. It's riddled with cuss words. Like, those little high schoolers, middle schoolers in that movie don't play around. So this is nothing compared to, in terms of language-wise. Content-wise, it's different, but, you know, clowns. Clowns, middle schoolers, what's the
difference? Well, 8th grade is still in theaters. I think we'd all recommend checking it out if you can. Jesse, I'm going to turn it back to you. You saw possibly the movie of the year.
Oh, no.
Sailor Moon Super S. Colon, the movie.
Yes. Sailor Moon, Super S, colon, the movie. What can you say? It's touring right now through...
There's been a restoration?
Yes. Crap. It's
a 70 millimeter print.
No. it's touring version. Through... Crap. I'm not remembering what it's called.
It's Places.
It's Places. Places are showing it. If you are a Sailor Moon fan, or if you're not a Sailor Moon fan and you thought, what is this Sailor Moon business about? You should check it out. It's plenty of fun. We're going to talk about, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about Mamma Mia in a little bit. I would compare it to Mamma Mia in terms of it's just a fun, giddy, colorful movie. Full of empowering young ladies, just, you know what, saving the galaxy, why not? Letterboxd says, the wicked Bad Yanu has come to capture all of Earth's children. Okay, so basically, there's a guy, he's going around, he's basically an evil bard. He's going around, he's got a flute or something. He's whistling, he's getting some children on an evil ship, and he's taking them off so that the evil queen, can steal their sugar energy. Or at least that's what the dub
translated
it to. Trying to steal their sugar energy so that she can absorb the world in a black hole. And
who hurt her?
I don't know. I love first of all that like all anime villainesses have the same voice of like Sailor Moon. It has come to this. I don't know. I'm not quite capturing it, but they all anime villainesses have this like same kind of seductress, but also evil voice. And that's besides the point. Look, I don't know, guys. Sailor Moon is delightful. She has it. Every one of them have a cutscene where they just, it goes to glitter and like sparkles. And it's like pretty guardian outfit make up. And then they turn into their outfits. I don't know. Every one of them.
I'd want that to happen.
You know what? And they have...
I've wanted to be a magical girl for forever.
You know,
so.
Yeah. They have magical powers. They have magical phrases. And they're always like... they always try to reason with the villains just with kindness. They're like, you cannot take over the world because... That would be, I don't know, I'm not doing this justice at all. Unlike Sailor Moon, who does plenty of justice. She just tries to save the world through kindness and friendship. I'm pretty sure that's her catchphrase, through kindness and friendship, or definitely something along those lines.
All I'll say is Sailor Moon 2020.
Listen, there's talking cats, there's really cute outfits, there's a lesbian couple that I'm here for.
Good, they kept that in?
They got that in, minorly. Yeah, yes, for sure.
Because I feel like in the U.S. cartoon, they censored, they made them like cousins
or
something.
There definitely is a scene where the evil... child's dealing witch lady is like, I'm just gonna leave everybody as children because then they can always experience happiness. And the two lesbian characters,
oh yeah,
yes, look over at each other and they're like, oh, but if you're always a child, you can't experience pleasure. And then they look at each other and wink, and I'm like, oh,
holy shit.
Okay, all right, I'm here for it.
You just be like, damn, you girls do you.
You girls do you. It makes me want to explore the series some, but also I'm a grad student. I don't have time for that, but it's great. It's delightful. I mean, I don't think you should go in. I think you should just go in ready to have some fun. And just experience pretty justice served with kindness and friendship. Okay? That's all I got, guys. It's justice.
Speaking of pretty justice served with dresses and wonderfulness, let's talk about 2008's Mamma Mia.
Let's talk about Mamma Mia.
Yeah, good transition.
Thank you.
I thought so too. First off, I think that we should make a franchise of these movies where we're just taking popular songs from a group and from just stick to the 60s and 70s and then making a whole musical
please,
about it. Like,
God,
we should
yes.
do that. It doesn't have to be ABBA. Just like find other groups and we can, you know, I think that would be a cool thing. Anyway, Mamma Mia 2008. We got people this year who are like, Iron Man is the best movie of 2008. Then we have the neckbeards who come out of their mom's basement and they're like, well, I think that The Dark Knight is the masterpiece of 2008. And then the intellectuals are like, well, I think that There Will Be Blood is the masterpiece of 2008. You know what, guys? You know what I got? Mamma Mia. This movie...
Mamma heckin' Mia.
As I put in my letterbox review, this movie is utter nonsense, but yeah, I loved it, darling.
Yes, yes.
It makes no sense. There's really no, like, A, B, or C plot. There's just, like, a soup gumbo thing that's just swirled around. Literally, this whole movie is an hour and 40 minutes of Amanda Seyfried and Meryl Streep and her booze...
Her
Colin
booze,
Firth,
not booze.
Pierce Brosnan,
okay.
And Stellan Skarsgård just dancing around a Greek island. Like, tell me that you wouldn't want to watch a movie where Meryl Streep, Amanda Seyfried, Colin Firth, Pierce Brosnan, and Stellan Skarsgård with Meryl Streep's best friends, Julie Walters and Christine Baranski, dancing around a Greek island. Meryl Streep wears overalls.
Oh, my God, those overalls.
She has this, like, extravagant dance number to Dancing Queen, where, like, all the women of the island get on this deck, and they all start dancing, and then they jump in the water, and, There's so many moments, guys, in this.
It's irresistible. It's just, like, so contagious, the fucking energy in this movie. Like, you can dance, you can jive. Heckin', yeah, I can. And I'm going to join this dance group, and we're going to dance around Greece, and then we're going to jump in the water. That's, like, perfectly crisp and turquoise and delightful in every way.
It has so many colors. There's the dance. I don't know the specific song, but they have that dance party late in the night on the first night they're there, where they're all like swirling in that courtyard, and there's like these red and this kind of darker red and blue and green and yellow, and it's all just kind of going all over the place, and it's just like these sexy bodies that are all just pressed up against each other. It got almost kind of like I was trying to think of a good example, but just like this, you know, surrealist moment where all of these colors and bodies are all coming together. I feel like Nathan would appreciate that scene. it's just, I don't know. You're going to watch it and you're going to be like, this doesn't make any sense. And then you're going to go back to your mom's basement. But if you open yourself to enjoy it, it's a pretty damn good time.
Yeah, and you don't need to sit on the couch and like cross your arms and think, well, what's this gonna be? Probably bullshit.
Well, I went to college, so I can't enjoy this.
Yeah, you just need to sit on the couch and be like, I don't need to think for a little while. I just need to stare at Grease and Amanda Seyfried and like live. And that's what you'll get. You'll just...
Amanda Seyfried is so damn happy in this movie. She's just so happy.
She's beautiful.
She's so... And I watched this like 2 days after I watched First Reform, so it was nice to see her getting up again. You know, she was...
And then the cutest thing is like, she's cute and sweet, and she's like, I'm getting married. Isn't that lovely? And then she has this like sexy scene with her boo on the ocean. I can't remember the song that plays. Hell, and then it gets all spicy. I'm here. Dominic Cooper coming up.
I'm like, damn, Dominic Cooper. I wasn't even
that into him. And then they had that nice, sexy little beachside song. I was like, hell yes.
I also love the dance sequence when Christine Baranski is like singing about how all the guys on the island want to fuck her. And I'm just like, I mean, it's amazing. It's great. Seriously, there's no plot to this movie. It's just dance number after dance number. And I loved every minute of it. It's just like a giant pick me up.
And I always think of her as the the girl who's in love with the Grinch from the live action The Grinch movie. That's my one and only context for her, and that's fine. It's fine. It doesn't matter.
my only selling point is Meryl Streep, Julie Walters, and Christine Baranski are best friends, and they just dance all over the place and are so excited to see each other. I like movies where all the stars are having like a really good time. Like, they're all pumped to be on this Greek island, and they know it's bullshit, but they're like, you know what? We're gonna dance around and have a good time. Screw you guys. Yes.
Make sure you pay attention when you watch it, because you're gonna watch it, because you're gonna hear us talking about it, and you're gonna be like, well, I guess I gotta check this out. I mean, there's that girl who wrote about it on the Cinematary, and now they're talking about it. Anyway, when you watch it, make sure you pay attention to like the non-main actors, like the people who work for the hotel and stuff, and just watch their faces during these sequences. They just always look so damn serious. So Meryl Streep's all here like 17 dancing queen, etc., and they look so fucking serious, and then they just jump in with like all of the intensity that they can summon, and they act the shit out of themselves. And I'm pretty sure they're not actors. I think they're probably just people who happen to be nearby, but it's great to watch them specifically too. But also Meryl Streep in those overalls is everything. It's perfect. It's utterly perfect.
She's my spirit animal.
I want to be her. I want to be on her. I want every bit. I want to capture that energy and have it. And love it. I love her. But I don't care about her generally. I only like her in this movie. And I mean, I'm sure there's some other things I like her into, but specifically in those damn overalls, in heckin' Grease, I'm there for it. I'm there for it. I love it. It's fantastic.
It's super true. I need to go see the new one. I don't know if I'll catch it in theaters, but I'll definitely catch it when it comes out on DVD. Mamma Mia, it's on Netflix. So get your thumbs out of your butt for Iron Man and Dark Knight and all that stuff. Just have a good time, guys. God, the world's gonna end soon. Just enjoy yourselves.
Pour yourself some sangria, like I have just had 3 glasses of, and watch Mamma Mia.
You've had 3 glasses of sangria? We're gonna take a short break. Maybe Jesse can get some water, and then we're gonna be back talking about Risky Business in part 2.
Hello, Cinematary listeners. This is Andrew Swofford with an important message during this break in the show. Cinematary would like you to know that we do not want your money, and we don't want to place ads in the show at this time. That's not why we do this. We do it because we enjoy each other's company and because we want to bring you our pure, unadulterated opinions on the world of cinema. However, there are a few things you can do to help out the show that we would greatly appreciate. Firstly, leave us a review on iTunes, preferably a positive one, because the algorithm gods tell us that reviews increase our podcast exposure. Secondly, send us a tweet at Cinematary, or better yet, send an email to cinematary@yahoo.com so that we can hear from you guys for a change. Maybe you think I'm an idiot for not liking Singing in the Rain, or maybe you have a suggestion of a movie that you really want to hear our opinion on. Regardless, let us know your thoughts, and we'll read them out and respond to them on future episodes of Cinematary. Finally, please share the show with friends and members of your family who you think would enjoy listening to and participating in our film discussions we bring to you guys every week. So to recap, review, send us your thoughts through Twitter and email, and share with your friends and family. We would truly appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Now let's get back to the show.
Back with part 2 of episode 207 of Cinematary. In this part, we'll be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with a pick that came from Twitter this past week. It is 1983's Risky Business. It will be our 1980s Young Critics movie for English language. The film was written and directed by Paul Brickman, making his directorial debut. It stars Tom Cruise, Joe Pantoliano, Curtis Armstrong, and Rebecca De Mornay. Because the movie took place, it was partially filmed in Chicago's affluent Highland Park suburb. Located along Lake Michigan, Brickman, who grew up in Highland Park, told Salon that, quote, the working title was White Boys Off the Lake. I think the studio rejected that because it sounded like an off-Broadway play. So we started doing word association to come up with a new title. Brickman also told Salon that Bernardo Bertolucci's The Conformist was a huge influence on the film. Quote, I thought, why can't you present that as a film for youth and aspire to that kind of style and still have humor in it? That was the test, to meld a darker form of filmmaking with humor. Tone is what I wanted to play with. Though Risky Business comes off as a satire about capitalism couched as a teen comedy, The Conformist is a political drama situated during Italy's 1940s fascist regime. Cruise was filming The Outsiders in Oklahoma when he got the call to audition for the film. Cruise told Interview, quote, originally Paul had seen Taps and said, this guy for Joel? This guy is a killer. Let him do Amityville 3. Somehow my agent, without me knowing, arranged to have me just drop by the office to say hello. So I went in wearing a jean jacket, my tooth was chipped, my hair was greasy, I was pumped up and talking in an Oklahoma accent. Hey, how y'all doing? Paul just sat there looking at me. Cruise returned to Tulsa, but flew back to LA and auditioned again. Quote, I walk in and see this stunningly gorgeous woman sitting there looking at me, and I'm thinking, oh my God, Cruise said. Rebecca had already been cast. They wanted to see the two of us together. I tested, and to make a short story long, we didn't test that well. Paul just believed in me. According to Cruise, he told Cameron Crowe how the dancing sequence unfurled. Quote, so I took the candlestick and I said, how about making this the audience? And then I just started ad-libbing, using it as a guitar, jumping on the table. I waxed half the floor and kept the other half dirty so I could slide in my on my socks. As we went along, I threw more stuff in, like the thing with the collar up, jumping on the bed. Originally, it was the only one line in the script. Joel dances in underwear through the house. We shot it in half a day. And Cruz dances way into really what people think most about with this movie. 10 years prior to casting Cruz and Jerry Maguire, Cameron Crowe spoke with him for an interview and asked him what he thought Risky Business was about. Cruz said, quote, "It's about today's capitalistic society. Do the means justify the ends? Do you want to help people, or do you want to make just want to make money?" Joel is questioning all of that. So am I. I'm not saying I'm just a erudite political figure, but it bothers me. At least I'm asking the question. The movie is Joel's exploration of society, how he gets sucked into this wild capitalistic ride. Wow. That was 1986 Tom Cruise. Cruz and Rebecca De Mornay dated in real life despite their incendiary love scenes. They didn't start dating until the film's release in late summer of 1983. The film was scored by Tangerine Dream. Their music comprises nearly half of the soundtrack, but it also includes songs by Muddy Waters, Prince, Jeff Beck, Journey, Phil Collins, and the song for which the film is best known for, Old Time Rock and Roll by Bob Seger. In 2006, the film was number 40 on Entertainment Weekly's list of the top 50 best Hollywood movies. The magazine called the film, quote, "a sharp satire of privileged suburban teens, portraying the soul-crushing pressure to be perfect." Roger Ebert called it a film of, quote, "new faces and inspired insights and genuine laughs, and one of the smartest, funniest, most perceptive satires in a long time that not only invites comparison with The Graduate, but earns it." Variety said the film was like a, quote, "promising first novel with all the pros and cons that come with that territory," and complimented Brickman on, quote, "the stylishness and talent of his direction." The New York Times called it part satire, part would-be suburban poetry, and part shameless showing off. Said the film shows an abundance of style, though you would be hard-pressed to find a film whose hero's problems are of less concern to the world at large. They call De Mornay disarming as a call girl who looks more like a college girl, and credits Cruz with making Joel's transformation from straight arrow to entrepreneur about as credible as it can be. On that note, guys... Girls. Chickalitas.
Yeah.
Chickatitas. What do you make of Risky Business? Lydia, I'm going to let you lead off.
I'm confused by everyone calling it a comedy or a satire, because I didn't think it was that funny at all. And B, I'm not sure that it's doing the whole satire thing. Jesse and I were talking about it the other day, live texting, I guess.
We were Snapchatting. It's fine.
It's more like a fantasy, just straight up wish fulfillment fantasy for shitty white boys.
Mm-hmm,
and yep. I don't think that counts as satire.
Yeah, I guess maybe you could say it's like a satire dramedy. I was a little bored, like, looking through reviews on Letterboxd where people were like, ugh, I don't even feel like this was a comedy, 2 stars. Like, that's the most you could say about it, was you don't think it's a comedy, so it's 2 stars. Like, there's a lot of reasons not to like this movie, but just because it's not funny is the least of those reasons. There's some funny moments.
Pantsless dancing around scene that's super iconic. That happens
pantsless
really early. And then the rest of the movie is the rest of the movie.
It's one of those things. I guess I can see the charming, quote, comedy elements of it, I guess, come in the form of kind of Home Alone ish scenes, like when he's just kind of dealing with stuff around the house since he's alone. I don't know. The thing I was thinking most about while watching this movie is you got this very early version of Tom Cruise, who I feel like has at least some semblance of a personality and charisma, and is trying to regardless of the movie's pitfalls, it does have a kind of charming persona whenever he gets more dealing with I'm trying to think what her name was.
Lana.
The call girl.
Lana. Couldn't be Lana. couldn't be Lena. It was Lana. Anyway, let's continue. It's besides the point.
But I was thinking about a comparison between Tom Cruise then and Tom Cruise kind of today, because one of the thoughts that kept going across my mind is that Tom Cruise today really isn't a human. I don't think he's a human anymore. I think at some point along the way, his human form died and they were like, oh, we can't lose Tom Cruise. And so then they made a robotic version of him that is like an automaton that's trying to mimic human personalities, because you see him in interviews today and just interacting on like talk shows, and he has this wide smile constantly, like he watched a television show, like television shows to say this is what humans look like when they're happy. And he gives these very stock answers, like it looks like an answer that he copied and pasted off of Yahoo Answers. And I don't know, he's such like, I think that's why he's perfect for Mission Impossible, because it's like, yeah, you gotta be a robot, like just go be a robot and do stuff. But here I guess you can see why Tom Cruise, you know, became more of a movie star, because he does have that a little bit of the suaveness that you would elicit to movie stars of the past. You know, like a Jimmy Stewart or Cary Grant, or just somebody who is kind of charming and good looking and is just kind of being irreverent and funny in that fashion. But I don't know. I don't think that this movie works. I don't buy its whole capitalistic intent. It kind of felt like a movie that came out actually earlier this year, which is Thoroughbreds, which kind of is, it's not the same plot, but it kind of has a similar line of trying to toe between this coming of age teen comedy and being this very dark and gloomy subject. And I thought that was one that at least spoke a little bit better to what Risky Business is trying to do. But this one didn't seem like it. Like, I think Tom Cruise is kind of talking out of his ass in that interview about what this is saying about capitalism.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Did anybody else see Thoroughbreds? Do you see any comparisons between that and this one?
I can't speak on Thoroughbreds, to be honest. I fell asleep. I saw a lot of comparisons on Letterboxd of this and Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, yeah.
I haven't seen Ferris Bueller in a hot minute. I do remember liking Ferris Bueller, and I remember I actually rewatched Risky Business, because I think I watched it maybe like a year to 2 years maybe ago with Andrew, and did not have strong feelings on it. And then you asked me to be on the podcast, Zach, and I was like, I'm gonna have to rewatch this. I don't remember what I thought about it. And Andrew was like, you didn't like it. I'm like, did I not? Okay, so I think at least with Ferris Bueller, if I'm making that comparison, and sorry to hijack what you asked, Zach, but I think that the movie is still like acknowledging that the characters are kind of shitty, and in Ferris Bueller, there's no sex workers, so we can get into that in a minute, and B, they don't get everything. Like, everything does not turn out fine for them in the end. I mean, mostly it does, because, like, he gets away with the whole skipping school thing, but, like, big fucking deal. People skip school all the time now. And, but in Risky Business, I feel like the movie kind of sets it up maybe a little more ambiguous of, like, is he a shitty kid? Is he a nightmare fucking child? Or is he just, like, just trying to be his best? Also, just as an aside, too, I said earlier, I'm studying to be a school counselor. I took a class this summer on, like, helping kids get into college, right? That's the job of a school counselor, is helping kids get into college. This asshole in this movie got a 3.14 GPA and, like, basically a lower 20s equivalent on his ACT, but he did the SAT. But you could probably compare it to, like, a low 20s on the ACT, right? This asshole with, like, a lower 20s ACT score and a 3.14 GPA, who grew up in Highland Park. I grew up in Highland Park, by the way. Thinks he's going to get into Princeton. Pissed me off. This kid is not going to Princeton. This kid would be lucky to go to U of I. And he's like, guess I'm going to U of I. LOLOL. no, like, U of I is also a competitive school. My brother went to U of I. I'm trying to collect my thoughts here.
I feel like Tom Cruise should have murdered someone in this one. They talk about wanting to go dark, and I feel like their version of dark is just introducing sex work and, like, pimps and a scary car ride. Tom Cruise should have straight up murdered someone. And also, he would have gotten away with it. Spoilers.
Well, that kind of adds to a point that Jesse was making, because it's not a movie where it's like, oh, the Tom Cruise character is just trying to, you know, get by and try to be better. Allegedly already better, and he's just like, well, I need to live my life and be worse. It makes it, I think, I guess that's supposed to be the oh, you know, we all want to let our hair down and just have fun sometimes. But and then of course when he does that, it goes out of control. But it seems like an extreme case.
It's not a cautionary tale though.
No, it's not like what lesson can you?
It's all fine.
And I guess you can blanket it under this statement that, oh, it's a movie, it's supposed to be absurd, but I don't know. It's supposed to be this movie about coming of age and capitalism and all this crap. And I'm like, yeah. I don't feel like it's any of that. I feel like it's just kind of letting Tom Cruise's teenage brain get kind of horny.
It's a horny, rich teenage boy fantasy. Yes.
I feel like a teenage boy wrote this movie. It's horny as shit. Like, not in a way that's enjoyable.
If this was a 2018, he wouldn't be calling prostitutes, he'd probably be getting angry while playing Fortnite and then shooting up a school.
Oh my god, Zach.
Just saying.
There's a scene. So the scene after he has the nice trans lady prostitute leave, and then she's like, you need to call my girl Lana because all the white boys on this side of the lake like Lana. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then he calls Lana. Lana's like, sure, I'll come over later. And then he falls asleep. And then Lana like rings the doorbell and he's still asleep, so she lets herself in. I guess I have a theory. I guess there's a way to read this movie, probably. I don't care to find out.
It's all a horny sex dream.
That it's all a horny sex dream. That he never actually... That Ew. She didn't actually come. She did actually come in his dream. But she
probably didn't,
she
though,
didn't
for real.
She didn't actually arrive at his house. Because he was asleep when she shows up. She just lets herself in the front door. Like, why wouldn't he have locked it? But anyway, and so you could probably read this to say, like, none of this actually happened.
He's
a
white boy. He doesn't feel like he needs to lock his house up.
Sure, but in the burbs, in suburbs, I don't know. Anyway, it's just everything works out perfectly for him. You know, but it's similar to Ferris.
He gets into Princeton.
Yeah, with a shitty GPA and shitty test scores. You know, okay, let me just say, you can get into Princeton with low GPA, with low test scores, but you've got to have a story. And your story isn't, oh, I let the guy who interviewed me fuck some of the prostitutes that I had over at my house. Your story needs to be something like, oh, I was homeless for 2 years and did my very best to catch up, but, like, you know, I know that my GPA lags a little bit, but I've tried my best and I've worked really hard. And then you have to have, like, some really good letters of recommendation saying, I've never seen a student work this hard in my life to catch up, blah, blah, blah.
All the teachers seem to hate Tom Cruise.
Yeah, you have to have a story to, if you have like a low GPA like that, and not just like, he's kind of shitty, but whatever. I mean, I got to meet him, and then I got to have sex with some prostitutes, and so yeah, he should definitely go to Princeton. It's infuriating. He gets into Princeton. He saves his dad's car after he got to drive it around and, like, you know, have the time of his life. He got to drive it around. He crashed it. He saves it. He makes some money. He gets to have, like, the best sex ever on a train. And
Lydia, you...
Why is this movie considered so good?
I think it also it kind of plays into this this 80s nostalgia glasses that we have in pop culture at the moment. I mean, just think about it. A lot of the stuff that's popular in pop culture is like these 80s things. You have remakes of 80s movies. You have Stranger Things on, you know, just dominating television. You have you even will bring back hit songs from the 80s, and they'll either be covers of them or they'll revitalize them in some sort of fashion in like a commercial or something. I think we have this deep nostalgia for this era for some reason, and I think that this fits in the mold of, I think Ferris Bueller is a good comparison. It fits this mold of, I mean, I guess you think of America in the 80s, you know, you're trying to, I guess their idea with the capitalistic satire is that you have, you know, you have Reagan in the White House, you have all of these strict rules in place to kind of keep people in line. You kind of have his parents who have this, you know, pretty bland story, you know, from the script conservatism that they have, that they're like, oh, you need to, you know, wake up and have breakfast and you need to go to school and, you know, you'll be a good boy, don't worry. But I just don't buy why what is driving Cruise's character to want to break away from that, other than I'm horny and I want to have like a thrill ride for a little bit. I like Jesse, your point about bringing up that this could possibly be a dream, because the way that this kind of connects to that being true is that it kind of opens with a dream. Like, you open with this kind of dream sequence happening, and it seems, and you also have Cruise's character constantly having these fantasies throughout the movie, so it could definitely be a dream. And I think that but I don't think they want to do that, because then it I guess it invalidates this kid's purpose. Yeah, it invalidates the satire and this kid's purpose in life, because if it was going to be a dream, I think he would have to kind of almost fall on his face in the end of it. And I don't think that they're smart enough to figure out a way to do that and then find some sort of, find some sort of ending that would satisfy viewers. They'd just all be depressed. I don't know.
He doesn't get into Princeton? That sucks. But he should have, because he's white and from Highland Park. Dang.
Yeah, I just don't think it's as cutting with what it wants to say. And I kind of say the same thing about Thoroughbreds, where it's not cutting to the point as well as it could have. I think that something like Sorry to Bother You, that we talked about a few weeks ago, is much more cutting about capitalism, even though I had my reservations about that one. This seems like another example of it's trying to toe two lines. And this is an even worse example, because this is one of those movies that tries to do that in the 70s and 80s. And rather than being They Live, it's more of a commercial version of trying to take on the system.
I don't think they are, though. I feel like that's an after-the-fact rationalization for the mess that this is. Like, Tom Cruise made that up later.
Lydia, I feel like you have a lot of thoughts on this that I kind of want to hear you drop out, because your review on Letterboxd was just gross, and then your Snapchat after watching it was just like gross. So maybe we've talked about it already, but what just overwhelmed you to be like, I don't like this movie?
Again, I think it's being forced to follow this main character who's objectively just really terrible. He uses everyone in his life, like, he's just leeching off of his parents, like everything good he has just because of his parents. And then I don't know, he's got these weird sex dreams that are tangled up with like school anxieties, and I feel I don't understand. I don't want to understand. And he's just so fucking thoughtless and dumb. And I hate his sweaters that he wears with collared shirts. And I just don't give a shit about his problems that he makes for himself and makes worse. And I'm not a fan of how this movie thinks is a fun, wacky way to make money is. Open up a brothel. That's funsies. This is weird that this is happening.
It's interesting to compare this with the movie we opened the episode on, Eighth Grade, where I was listening to interviews with Bo Burnham this week, and on a couple of them, he talked about how he chose to make the main character a girl because he was like, whenever you watch these videos similar to Kayla's on YouTube by eighth grade girls, they're always about like their souls and their, you know, exploring yeah. their, you know, their
interiority their and like, yeah. yeah.
And they're exploring that. So he's much more interesting. He's like, all the boys do is rage and play Fortnite.
Minecraft.
Yeah, Fortnite and Minecraft. And that's definitely a 2018 example. But I think we see that example in the 1983 fashion in this movie, with all they're doing is complaining that the girls aren't having sex with them. And I mean, what's appealing about them outside of that? They're just, they have Tom Cruise's character's case, he has money, and the rest of them are just kind of high school boy bums. Like they're not necessarily awful, but they're just sleazy, weird, greasy guys. You know,
there's dudes that would definitely try to grope a 14-year-old.
Exactly.
They're the dudes driving in the car.
there's nothing intrinsically interesting about them. And I don't know. I feel like we're just hitting this with a lot of 2018 brain. But I also think that we should at least kind of take it back and question why these have become such pop culture figures, and there's no room for something a much more empathetic work like eighth grade that can also be funny and work well. But this is the classic, you know.
I said this to Jesse. Like, I think this speaks to their need to be more diversity in the people who make these like 50 top Hollywood film lists of all time, because my experience watching this movie, and Jesse's, I think, not to speak to your experience, but watching this movie, it was just like boring, gross bullshit. And I didn't have a good time. I didn't think it was fun. I didn't think it was just lighthearted or whatever. And if it's a satire, it was a very poor one. And it's just like, if a bunch of dudes who have 80s nostalgia like pick the things that go on these lists and hold them up as really great examples, they're not. It doesn't deserve to be there.
I was nervous to be on the podcast because I was like worried that people might say, you know, you're not supposed to take this movie too seriously. It's just for fun. And like, do we really need to like criticize this movie from a feminist lens of, okay, sure, it's about a teenager who engages in sex work, etc. He's 17, by the way. He's 17. The movie sets him up as 17. So he's not even 18. He's not really even of the age of consent, but it's fine.
Yeah, I really want to say I don't think prostitutes would work with
because but honestly, I was scrolling through Letterboxd, as I said earlier. There's not a lot of negative criticism of the movie. It wasn't really fleshed out. It was like, this wasn't that funny, or just didn't really even think this was that good. And not a lot of, I don't know,
like critical really engagement?
Reasoning.
Yeah,
yeah, sure. I also, I don't necessarily see the harm in general of a movie that's like kind of about a fantasy. So you could compare this to like a chick flick for a girl, of like watching, you know, a fantasy of like a romance that blossoms and then they get married and then it's, but I think you just have to compare in terms of like, is this harmful? And so do we think that this movie is harmful, and if so, why, is my thought process.
It also, that point brings up this thought that I've been having a lot since watching Hannah Gadsby's comedy special Nanette, where she says hindsight is a gift. We have, you know, we don't have to revere this movie just because it has this reverence already and it's hailed as this great high school movie or this great movie from the 80s that the people who are making the decisions like it. We don't have to just accept that. I think that even though we may be thinking about this through a feminist lens or a 2018 lens, I think that's it's nice that we do that, because I think you're right. Like, we don't have to just accept this as a classic because that's where it's been predestined. Honestly, I think it's just a classic because people like that dance sequence. Guys, it's 45 seconds long.
I think so. Like,
yeah.
And it happens really early on. If you turn the movie off after the dance sequence, that's fine. That's enough of that movie.
Yeah, you'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally the 80s equivalent of liking something just because of a gift that you found. Like, it's just one moment that really... And I just find that this movie has nothing to say except, isn't it nice that these rich white guys who are horny are able, like, to get off
get laid
by the end of
yeah.
it? Yeah, like why should we be invested in that? Even as a straight white guy, like, why do I care that these rich white boys are gonna get laid? Like, there was some pressing issue that was keeping them from that for like millions of years. Like, they were gonna be fine. Like, it was gonna be okay. They're 17, and it just seems like in this world where, you know, masculinity is supposed to be validated, and and men are supposed to be validated in their thoughts and feelings and what they want to do. It just seems like another example of affirming that. And I think that it should not be in any canon of great 80s movies, because it's just not as fun in hindsight as maybe people thought in 1983. And I think that it's okay in today to be like, yeah, let's just take that out. There's nothing to grasp from it. Like, you're not losing anything. You can make a gif of the dancing sequence and then we can move on.
Yeah, just why don't you just know that the dancing sequence exists, then go in your own house, just wear your underwear, play the song, and dance yourself. Like, that will be better and more fun for you than watching this stupid fucking movie. And then also, just, I don't know, the scene that just, like, really soured my stomach, probably most of all, was at the end of the night. So, like, the fun, yay, brothel sequence is over, and the girls are all kind of, the girls.
Women.
The women, the call yes. girls, are all, they're finished. They're finished for the evening. Their work is done. They look exhausted. And I thought to myself, like, what was their average number of horny, rich Highland Park boys that each woman had to encounter that evening? And it's just, like, grossed me out. Because Tom Cruise, like, all he had to do was, like, wear a blazer and some glasses and then go get himself laid on a train, and, like, he made $5,000. And these poor women, I don't know, like, guys.
But it's fun.
It's,
they got
it's
laid.
Fine. It's the 80s. It's fine. Ha ha.
If anything, it's not satirizing capitalism. It's affirming capitalism, because yeah. in a capitalistic system, the men get all the gains and have the power, and they just use the women to get up there. So
yeah. And like, the fact that all these boys are like, it's fine, I'll just go to the bank and take out my bond that my grandparents, who, like, survived the Depression or something, saved for me. No big deal. But, like, if...
That was really shitty.
I mean...
It's no big deal. It's fine. But it's fine. I'll just take that out so I can have sex with, like a white cis prostitute lady. That'd be fine.
It also blows my mind that all of his friends have so much money to them. And, like, if you need the money to fix your car, if your friends are so shitty that they won't just lend it to you, or, like, give you a predatory loan because, hey, make some money. Like, you have to predicate getting money off your friends from exploiting other people's bodies, specifically women's bodies. Like, rethink your whole fucking deal.
Like, it would matter to me if I went to the bank and pulled out $300 so that I could have sex with a prostitute. That would be a problem. But these guys are like, it's fine. Like, whatever. No big deal. Like, my parents will just give me more money and then I'll just go to Princeton. It's fine.
Yeah, I think that there had to be a degree of ramifications. There was no ramifications. The
Not
ending is
all.
Just, he
well,
got
shoot,
away with it.
He scratched
How about
the egg.
That?
His mom is so disappointed in him.
Heck.
Darn.
Yeah, it's just, you have this buildup, like, I don't know. I think that the tension in the movie was supposed to be, can he get out of this? Can he solve this issue? And I'm like, no, he should probably have to deal with the consequences. Like, that would
probably.
Be much better than yeah, he should, because that would be much more of a dramatic shift.
More character
than
building.
Happened. more, it would be much more of an interesting character if he's left with this thing in shambles, because he's continually and continually dealt with this like Oedipal complex that throughout the movie, where he wanted to find more women and more women to sleep with, and he continued to lose money and lose house items. Like, he should have to deal with the ramifications of that, and it was more, aw shucks, he got away with it. You know, I don't know. It's not Ferris Bueller running back to class at the end of that movie. It's just, it's not that.
Yeah, there's no growth. There's no lesson learned. There's like, if anything, I felt like what he really should have learned at the end of the movie was, yeah, I probably shouldn't go to Princeton. I should probably do something else with myself. But no, he gets into Princeton, like, everything's fine.
He can only fail up. That's the lesson. White boys fail up. Like, it doesn't matter how big of a fuck up you are. Your parents or so just come and bail you out, and like none of the mistakes you made will matter.
I didn't fail up, guys, because I got to do this podcast with you all.
Yay. Girls night.
This is a fun girls night.
Girls night.
Does anybody have any final thoughts about Risky Business before we wrap up?
Look, this is available on Amazon or something. Don't watch it. Don't worry about it. It's not worth the $2 that I spent on it. If you really like the song Old Time Rock and Roll, listen to the song Old Time Rock and Roll in your underwear, and then watch another Tom Cruise movie, maybe, or don't. I don't know. If you
have like an iPod or something, just download the song and listen
something
to it there.
Different, yeah.
Watch Mamma Mia. It's much better.
Yeah, watch Mamma Mia.
There we go.
And or like watch Stranger Things if you need some 80s nostalgia. I don't know, guys.
Or just recognize the 80s sucked and you're just controlling our culture with your shittiness.
Just wear some neon colors and like a high top pony and call it a day.
Yeah, we're not living it anymore. Yeah. Wear a fucking dorky sweater and a button up.
You're welcome.
We're coming out hot. All right. Well, that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we posted the movies that we talked about in this episode. Next week, we will be concluding our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series, finally, with 1986's The Green Ray. Definitely come back to check that out. Again, check out our reviews of Eighth Grade, Hillbilly, and the Mamma Mia Maniac on the site. Give us a little subscribe on Apple Podcast, and yeah, it was a good girls' night, guys.
Yeah, girls' night.
This is what women talk about when men aren't around.
They rant about Risky Business.
This
you
is
learned
our locker
so much.
Room talk. It's about feminist issues in 80s movies.
All right, guys, have a good week.
Yes.